This morning, in this part of Focus 5, Eddie, we'll be talking about oil and oil supplies around the world. Back in 1956, a geologist named M. King Hubbert predicted that oil production in the United States would peak in the early 70s and then would decrease sharply. At the time, he was criticized. In fact, some people ridiculed his prediction. But as it happens, he was right. Now, this morning, we'll be talking about how the same kind of analysis can be applied to world oil supplies. And our guest is Kenneth DeFays. He is Emeritus Professor of Geosciences at Princeton University. He's written the book entitled Hubbert's Peak, The Impending World Oil Shortage. The book is published by the Princeton University Press. And in the book, he makes the argument that if you apply the same sort of reasoning that Hubbert did when he looked at the question of U.S. oil supplies and production, you apply that to the world, you will see that, in fact, we may now be at or very near the peak of world oil production and should expect within the next couple of decades for world oil production to decline significantly. We'll go over that in some detail this morning with our guest and, of course, take your questions. Just a little bit more about Kenneth DeFays. He grew up in the oil fields. His father was a petroleum engineer. He worked for Shell Oil at their research lab in Houston and was a colleague of Mr. Hubbert. He joined the faculty at Princeton in 1967 and continued to work in the industry as a consultant and expert witness. He's perhaps best known to general readers as the guide and mentor to John McPhee's series of popular books on geology. And again, the book we talked about, Hubbert's Peak, is out in bookstores now if you want to look at it. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And if you match the numbers and the letters, you get WILL. So 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Professor DeFays, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it. Maybe first you should tell us a little bit about M. King Hubbert.
Well, M. King Hubbert was a salty character. There was an expression around the Shell lab borrowed from another source that said that Hubbert is a bastard, but he's a higher bastard. And he was fearsome in an argument. Actually, I got along very well with him. But he made this prediction, and even his own management was on the phone right down to the last 15 minutes before he got up to give the talk the first time, saying, don't do it, don't do it. And he turned out to be right. And for some years, the 100 years it's taking us to find and produce most of the world's oil compared to the 250 million years that it took geologic processes to make the oil seemed like a little tiny pimple, and it was called Hubbert's Pimple. And that was the original title of my book, and then the publicity department, the sales department, was very happy when we changed it to Hubbert's Peak.
I can imagine they would think that for the Princeton University Press would not be a suitable title. You mentioned in the book that before Hubbert, other people had attempted to answer the same question, that question being, you know, how much oil is there and how long can we expect to produce at these levels? And people came up with different answers. And before Hubbert, it turned out that they were wrong. How is it that, what was it that he did differently? Or perhaps was there some data that the other people didn't have that enabled him to make the calculation and be correct?
Well, a lot of the people before had simply taken the known reserves in the ground and divided by how much we produce each year and said, we're going to run out in 11 years. And about every 10 years, somebody would rediscover that fact. But of course, during that 10 years, we'd find some more oil. And Hubbert did a better analysis, and he took history as history, but he also quizzed a couple of experts that he really trusted, actually, and they were from what's the company that's now Exxon, and they said, well, it's between 150 and 200 billion barrels that the U.S. will produce by the time it's all done. And so he took that number to control what size of a curve would fit the oil production. The other thing that Hubbert did was to use discoveries the rate that we were finding new oil as an additional piece of evidence. So he added that in.
Just, I'm curious now if we can put some numbers on production. Let us say, can we make a comparison between what production in this country was at the peak, which was, I guess, around 1970, and how does that compare with what production is today?
We're producing about half of what we produced in 1970. That's part of the reason I left the oil business. I looked at the year I was scheduled to retire, 1999, and the U.S. oil business, by Hubbard's prediction, was going to be down to half of its peak size. And I decided there might be a lot more things more fun to do than live in Libya or Iraq or Iran or somewhere where they were still finding oil.
And how much more, if we, again, we just look at the United States, the resources that we have in this country, how much more oil do we have, and how much longer can we expect to be pumping it?
Well, we're on the sharp decline side of the curve. We'll be pumping small amounts of oil for another 100 years, but those little dribs and drabs at the end are much more valuable for petrochemicals and much more valuable for lubricating oil than they are to just go out and burn it. So I predict that the last part of the, already 10% of the world's oil production goes into petrochemicals. It's, you know, the nylon and the fabrics and most of our clothes, the rugs, those things are all petrochemicals.
Is there, and I suppose that some people nurse this notion that there is a lot of, that there are oil reserves, there's oil under the ground out there in the world that we haven't found yet. Can we really say today that we have a good idea where most of the oil is? And it's not the case that we're going to stumble on a big amount of oil somewhere that we didn't already know was there.
Well, geologists have gone practically everywhere, including Antarctica. But one interesting point is that in northern Alaska, where the giant Prudhoe Bay field is, and where the debate is now about drilling the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, there's a big naval petroleum reserve called Naval Petroleum Reserve Number 4. But that was set up in the 1920s. They already knew that the Arctic coast of Alaska was going to be big-time oil country in 1920. So we've kind of been to the ends of the world a long time ago.
Since you touch on it, and since it is in the news now, because in the Senate they're debating again the possibility of opening the wildlife refuge to drilling, does that make any sense to you?
It's so small that it doesn't matter one way or the other. If you give it your wildest dreams, and it's about half as big as the Prudhoe Bay field, I've drawn up the U.S. expected history with and without ANWR, and it does not run our production back up. Our production will still continue to decline even if they drill the ANWR Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and hit big.
So you would agree with those people who say, well, you can go and do that if you want to, but the fact of the matter is that also setting aside the issues of the amount of time that it would take to develop the field and the fact that you would have to ship the oil and so forth, setting all that aside, you can go and drill there if you want to. But when you look at the amount that we are using, what we would gain would be the proverbial drop in the bucket.
That's right. And the worst part about it is not whether we gain or lose that oil, but that we spend all of our political effort debating a side issue. The old joke is you're debating about how to arrange the deck chairs on the deck of the Titanic.
Let's just, and now for a second, to turn to the issue of world supplies. What you have done is taken the kind of approach that Mr. Hubbard applied to the United States and asked the same question. Let's look at what we know about oil reserves around the world, look at the level of production, and ask this question, well, where are we? And your conclusion is that we should be near the peak. We maybe have even already passed the peak of world oil production?
That's correct. And the real reason behind it is that the last good year we had on exploration, really finding significant amounts of oil, was 1975. Since then, we've not been finding oil as fast as we're pumping it out. And that's the real underlying cause. Now, that's not how I did the analysis, but when I look back, having made the prediction and said, well, how did we get here? It was not finding big reserves since 1975.
And is there anything out there, again, that we know is there that has not been tapped yet?
Well, there's one big question mark left, and that's the South China Sea. Well, six different countries claim the oil rights to the South China Sea, and there are two or three rocks out in the middle that would carry ownership out to the, you know, halfway to the adjacent coast, and several different countries claim those rocks. And because of that political barrier, there's only been some exploration in what's clearly the individual country's rights right around the edge, and a fair amount of that's turned out to be natural gas. It's unlikely that the South China Sea is going to be another Middle East, and that's what we need to bail us out now, is a whole other Middle East.
And if you look at other places around the world, particularly places where we would know the conditions would be extremely difficult, wherever one could imagine, Siberia, the bottom of the ocean, whatever, that, again, setting aside the technical difficulties, it sounds as if you're saying that it seems extremely unlikely that we would ever find a place where there is as much oil as there is in the Middle East, which is where there is the most?
That's right. Siberia turned out to be mostly natural gas. Big natural gas fields, but natural gas, not oil. And in the case of the deep ocean, we've drilled it not for oil, but for science, and the sediments aren't thick enough. In order to heat the organic matter hot enough to form oil, you have to bury it about 7,000 feet, and the sediments on the open sea floor are about 3,000 feet thick, and that just X's off three-quarters of the Earth's surface as being places to go look for oil.
And one of the things you explain in the book is the fact that to geologists, it's no mystery why there is oil, where it comes from, and where we should expect to find it. If you know about the geology, then you ought to be able to, it sounds as if you ought to be able to make at least an educated guess whether there's likely to be oil there or not.
Well, that's right. And the other reason I wrote those four chapters on where oil comes from and how it gets found is to say that, excuse me, I'm just getting over a cold, where oil is found, that my point is a lot of these things were known in the 1920s and 1930s, and so we can't just say all of a sudden, well, let's drill deeper. No. The oil, if it's buried beyond 15,000 feet, cracks to form natural gas. And we already had drilling rigs big enough to drill to the bottom of that's called the oil window, to drill to 15,000 feet. We already had drilling rigs big enough in 1938 to drill that deep.
We have a couple of callers who want to bring them into the conversation, and certainly anyone who is listening, if you have questions, you are welcome to call. Our guest is Kenneth DeFays. He is Professor Emeritus of Geosciences at Princeton University. And if you're interested in reading the book that he's written on this subject, it's titled Hubbert's Peak. The subtitle is The Impending World Oil Shortage. It's published by the Princeton University Press. And as we have explained, takes this analysis that had first been used by this geologist named Hubbert to look at oil supplies and production here in the United States, in which he argued, and he made this argument in the 50s, that oil production in this country would peak in the early 70s, and then it would decrease sharply. At the time, of course, people said he was wrong, and in fact, it turned out he was right. And what our guest, Kenneth DeFays, has done is taken the same kind of approach to looking at the issue of world oil supplies. And in the book, he makes the parallel argument that, in fact, we are very likely at or near the peak of world oil production, that we should expect it to decline significantly, and that there's not a heck of a lot we can do about it. Your questions welcome, 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana folks, but we do also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Here's a couple of callers here. First is Peoria, line number 4.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, what about the Royal Dutch Shell? They have a lot of oil, I understand, and also in Alaska. Why don't they re-refine the oil nowadays? They used to do it years ago.
Well, there are two things. Royal Dutch Shell, a month ago, the president of Royal Dutch Shell held a news conference in New York City and said, we can see beyond the era when crude oil is going to be our main business, and Shell is putting several billion dollars into solar energy and wind energy. Part of the reason why we're not finding oil like we used to, I claim those early petroleum geologists were pretty smart. They were good guys and knew what they were doing. But here's an analogy. I have a little bass pond down on the farm, and if I go out there and I catch bass and, you know, cook them for supper, it's really great, and then I start noticing I'm finding fewer and fewer bass. Well, you know, one of the messages might be you've caught most of the bass in the pond. But you could keep going to the fishing tackle store and buying more and more expensive rods and reels and lines and so forth, hoping to catch more bass. But, you know, one argument is it's not the fault of your rod and reel. It's the fact that you've caught most of the bass in the pond. Things are slowing down.
What about re-refining the oil?
Well, in the last really good year we had worldwide finding oil was 1975. And since then, now we've gone a quarter century not finding it as fast as we're pumping it out. And that seems to be a pretty strong message, that if the major oil companies with all their dollars, people, techniques, and so forth, and research effort aren't finding it, then that's a pretty strong message to the rest of us that they've already found most of the biggies.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. It sounded like maybe, I don't know, maybe I misheard the caller, but he was asking about, and I guess I thought he was asking about essentially recycling oil, taking what used oil products that we can and being able to use them again.
Well, we reuse lubricating oil, but the gasoline and the diesel fuel are burned up. There's no recycling that.
Okay, yeah, they're gone. Well, they're gone. So just again to underline the point, and that's really the, you know, we spent about the first 15 minutes of the show talking about that. To again to anybody though who asked that question, well, why don't we go out in there and find the oil? Well, you would say that we know where it is. There's no more undiscovered oil. We think there's pretty much no more undiscovered oil to be found. We know what oil. We know where it is, and we know how much there is, and that's that.
That's right. We've drilled all those places.
Okay. Another caller here in Sycamore, line number 1.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah. I'm curious to know about some of the more advanced recovery techniques. I know when we had our shortages in the 70s, a lot of effort was put into recovering additional oil from existing wells using hot pumping techniques, and then there was oil shale and several of these other techniques that are more expensive, but when the price of oil rises to meet that demand, won't it be available?
Well, the answer there is that there are fewer of those advanced recovery projects running in the United States this last year than there were in 1980. So that sort of business has shrunk, not enlarged. Secondly, a lot of the ideas that were being tried out in the 1980s, like using detergents to mobilize the oil, didn't work out. Carbon dioxide injection works very well, and that's expanding, but several of the methods aren't working. Now, that's conventional oil fields in a conventional way. There are unconventional things, and the one that's being something of a success are the tar sands up in Canada. Most of the companies actually mine the sand and heat it up with hot water in a plant and get the stuff out and then dump the sand back. The oil shale, which we have in Colorado and Wyoming and Utah, doesn't have oil in it. It has organic matter. When you heat it up, it cracks into smaller molecules and makes oil, all right. But the trouble is the shale fluffs up, and you can't poke the used shale back in the hole that you mined it out of. And you're going to have to commandeer a canyon somewhere and fill it up with used shale. So that one has receded. And on the time scale I'm talking about, 4 years, we can't hope to get anything out of the oil shale business. We'll get some amount out of the tar sands up in Alberta.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Next caller is in Belgium, over by Danville, line four. Hello.
Hello. To change the topic just ever so slightly, here in Illinois, and Mr. Inge has had previous guest speak of this, we have enormous amounts of coal. South Africa has turned coal into any number of petroleum-type products, all the way from lubricants to fuels to rayon, anything, not rayon, but nylon and things like that. What's wrong with using this?
Oh, there's nothing wrong. And in fact, even before the South Africans, during World War II, the Germans flew most of their aircraft on oil made from coal. Coal burned straight as fuel is the worst possible thing from the standpoint of adding carbon to the atmosphere, because it's almost pure carbon, whereas natural gas on the other end has four hydrogens and one carbon, and the hydrogen just becomes water when it's burned. So coal straight as fuel is going to be a problem about adding carbon dioxide to the air. And in particular, China has a lot of people and a lot of coal. And it's going to be very hard to convince the Chinese not to, to burn lots of it. The synthetic fuels, certainly the technology exists. I don't think we could get an industry pumped up in the United States in the next 4 years, but it certainly is a possibility, and it'll be expensive, but it can be done.
Well, I was referring mainly to using the coal for the lubricants and the other the raw materials for other processes, not so much as a fuel, because, as you said, there's lots of natural gas, and natural gas would make a far better fuel than the coal would.
Okay. The hardest industry to get off the liquid fuel business is the aircraft industry. They use... it's kerosene, really, stuff from crude oil, and that's going to be the hardest group to find a substitute for. You can drive a car with natural gas, the Navy can run ships with nuclear power, but the aircraft are going to be the most stubborn ones to keep flying.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thanks. We are just about at our midpoint here, and we are talking with Kenneth DeFays. He's an emeritus professor of geosciences at Princeton. His book, if you'd like to read it, published by the Princeton University Press, it's titled Hubbert's Peak, The Impending World Oil Shortage. Questions welcome. Just for a second, and I have a couple of other callers, I promise we'll get right to them. I wanted to ask you about the predictions, the projections about world oil production. As we've mentioned, you're projecting that if we haven't already hit the peak, we should expect to hit the peak of world oil production maybe within the next couple of years. And then the same thing should happen that we've seen with U.S. production. That is, we should see a significant decline over the next couple of decades. What is world oil production now, and what sort of declines do you think we are likely to see?
Oh, world oil production now is about 67 million barrels a day. And of that, 8 comes from Saudi Arabia, which is the biggest single exporter. The Saudis have announced that they can go up to 10.5 million barrels a day. That's their capacity. But to have 2.5 million barrels kind of held as a reserve out of a world total of 67 is not very good news. And as the rest of the world declines, I think the immediate squeeze coming up in another 2 or 3 or 4 years is going to be that the rest of the world declines to the point where the Saudis are producing flat out their full 10.5 million capacity. And at that point, we're using it all. we're using the entire world production capacity day by day as we burn it up.
And how long can we continue to do that?
Well, in another 10 years after the peak, we're down 15% or so in world oil production. The trouble is the population continues to increase. The ambition of people around the world to increase their standard of living increases. And as we learned in California a year ago, a 5% shortfall in the supply compared to the demand can triple the price, because if you're talking about electricity for the house, if you're talking about gasoline because you're a commuter and have to travel 30 miles every day, you'll bid that price up pretty high before you'll give up your job or let the house go dark.
We have some other folks to talk with. Let's continue. And our next caller is in Champaign, and that's line two. Hello.
Hello, good morning. I missed the very first part of the program, so you may have addressed this, but it seems to me that, you know, as people talk about shale and things like that, other extraction methods get, you know, harder and harder, not only on the pocketbook, but on the environment. I mean, this notion of mowing down mountains so that we can extract oil from rocks to run cars seems a little, you know, bizarre to me, and ugly as well. But it just seems like it's time to move on to the next stage. I mean, we know now how to develop technologies to get rid of internal combustion engines and, you know, design hypercars that not only don't have to run on gasoline but can get by on very little fuel at all. And you know, in terms of for the house and business and others, all kinds of ways of producing energy that are renewable. And, you know, I mean, it seems like it's time for us to demand and you know, expect that we're going to start, you know, going forth developing these new technologies and transforming our economy.
Well, the problem is how fast. And I agree with you on the 20-year time scale. You've got it absolutely right. We have to go to renewable resources. But my problem is that if it happens, as I predict, in the next 4 years, there's not time enough to do all that, to build energy-efficient houses, to go over to renewable energy sources. And it's the time constant that I find is scary. It's the fifth year and the sixth year, not the 20th year, that has me frightened. We should have started on the agenda you were talking about 10 years ago. But, you know, after 1980, the price of oil went back down again, and everybody said, oh, no problem.
Well, it seems like we're ostriches with our heads stuck in the sand. I'm sure as prices go up that will motivate people, but, you know, I mean, the sooner we get started on it, the better.
Well, that's right. Now, individuals can start right now by getting the house insulation upgraded if it needs that. If you can find a way to get out from under a long commute, either by moving your job or moving your house, moving your residence, buying one of these fuel-efficient cars. What I regret, however, is that there's a 99-mile-a-gallon diesel being marketed in Europe, and they're not selling that in the U.S., and we need that sort of thing.
Well, and I think we ought to be moving on towards developing fuel cells for cars as well. And you know, I mean, I just think that it's time to start looking at replacing the internal combustion engine. It's just, you know, it's a technology that hasn't markedly improved in the last three generations, you know, and you're just not going to make it that much more efficient.
Well, that's true. And look, amongst the major oil companies, BP has called themselves Beyond Petroleum, and they used to be British Petroleum, and Shell Oil announced that they, a month ago, announced that they could see beyond the end of the oil era and are putting several billion dollars into wind and solar energy. But after the president of Shell made that announcement in a news conference in New York City, neither the New York Times nor the Wall Street Journal picked that up.
Amazing. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Chicago, line one. Hello.
Good morning. Something that's always puzzled me, all these things that we see now, like carpeting, vinyl tile, plastic bags, milk cartons, are they all made from petroleum?
Well, most of them are. Not all of them, but it's the preferred way of making the monomers that get polymerized to make plastics. So that, yes, an awful lot of the fibers...
In carpeting, especially?
Well, the nylon, there you can still buy wool carpets, yes. But you pay extra for it.
Are all these other things recyclable, carpeting, plastic bags, vinyl, floor covering?
Well, some of these things are recyclable, and I certainly, you know, at home, recycle the milk cartons and the tin cans and that sort of stuff. A used carpet is a pretty ugly thing, and I doubt that we're going to see that sort of stuff recycled very much.
What becomes of it? Is that incinerated then?
No, recycled stuff, they melt the plastic down and reuse it. There's certain kinds of plastic they can just remelt.
Yeah.
The polyethylene family can be reused that way. The glass bottles are, now they don't refill them, they melt them down. But I've even seen roads here in New Jersey painted, paved with broken glass bottles.
No kidding.
Asphalt. It works out nicely.
All right, then. Thank you.
All right. And again, we'll go to another caller here back locally. This is Urbana, line three. Hello.
Yes. Could you tell me how much, what percentage of our oil consumption goes to the fueling aircraft as opposed to, say, automobiles and trains and... trucks and that sort of thing?
I don't happen to know that number. I know that the automobile is the biggest user, but no, I don't happen to know what fraction goes into the airlines.
Yeah, I was just wondering whether it seems to me for a number of other reasons now since September 11, actually, that moving from aircraft to rail transportation would be a progressive step in this country.
Well, it certainly is working out here in the Northeast. The high-speed Boston to New York to Washington train is now competitive with the airlines. When you take the time extra they want you to get to the airport, you can get to Washington, D.C. faster on the train than you can by waiting in line in the airport, riding the shuttle to Washington, D.C., and getting through the mess at the other end.
Yeah, I'd like to see that in Illinois instead of all the discussion about building a third airport in Kankakee. So, well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and I should introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Kenneth DeFays. He is Emeritus Professor of Geosciences at Princeton University and has been around oil and the oil business for a long time. His father was a petroleum engineer. He worked for Shell and then went to Princeton, and even after being at Princeton, continued to work as a consultant and expert witness for people in the petroleum industry. And he is the author of the book Hubbert's Peak. The subtitle is The Impending World Oil Shortage. Princeton University Press is the publisher. And as we mentioned at the beginning of the program, the title makes reference to a geologist, a man who worked also for Shell, and our guest here knew him. A fellow named M. King Hubbert, who in 1956 predicted that oil production in the United States would peak in the early 70s and then would sharply decrease. At the time, people scoffed, but it turned out that he was right. And then what our guest here, Kenneth DeFays, has done is applied the same kind of analysis to world oil production, and he makes the argument in his book that we've either seen or are very close to seeing the peak of world oil production sometime perhaps within the next couple of years, if we haven't seen it already, and that his prediction is, as was the case with production in the U.S., that we should expect within the next couple of decades to see a significant decrease in world oil production. Your questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. We have other callers here, and our next person is in, I believe, in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Yeah, I was just wondering if the professor would explain briefly what the current theory is about production of oil. I know that in general it's thought to be organic animal tissue, which over the centuries, over the eons, gets turned into oil. But in terms of finding it, how do you? I mean, if I look at a globe, am I right to think that all the land masses have? If I were looking at a globe that had pins where exploration has been tried, that all the land mass on the globe has been looked at, for oil, or has it been just certain areas? And if so, how have geologists narrowed the search area down, given that they're looking for things which happened millions of years ago?
Well, first thing is, as you go over the land area, if the rocks you have at the surface are granite and metamorphic rocks that have been cooked at high temperature, okay, forget it. That stuff is way too hot for oil to be preserved. And so it's first the places where there are layers of sedimentary rocks that are our primary target. Then and that's still half to two-thirds of the land surface works out that way. The next thing we do is do some test drilling, or, of course, in the old days, there were wildcatters would just try and look at the sediments that they bring up and find out, is there some organic matter there? Has the organic matter been heated hot enough to make oil? And so we gradually narrow it down. But that process has been done around the entire world. The exception I mentioned earlier is the South China Sea, where six different countries are claiming it. But that's the only underexplored area in the whole world at this point.
Hmm. You wouldn't look, for example, then at the Amazon, because you don't see sediments on top. But is the theory so strong that you would necessarily find sedimentary rock on top? Or isn't there any room at all for the possibility that we've got we've only got a probability maybe that we're depending on when we only look at the top layer of the crust?
Well, it gets hotter as you go down, and we know that beyond 15,000 feet, the oil cracks down to form natural gas, so that the first 15,000 feet is the sole target for oil, and we already had drilling rigs in 1938 big enough to drill to 15,000 feet. There is one physicist, Tommy Gold at Cornell University, who claims that organic matter is coming up, natural gas is coming up through the crust, and that it's not organic matter like almost all petroleum geologists think, but it's stuff coming out of the crust. Well, he talked the Swedes into drilling an enormously deep hole in a meteorite scar where a meteorite crashed into Sweden, and they didn't find boo. They drilled a big hole there, and they found no natural gas at all. So they found a little tiny dribble of it. And so that's the only competing argument. It's the thing that Tommy Gold makes, claiming that natural gas is coming up from the inside of the earth.
Well, it just seemed to me that that sedimentation, I understood, had to do with erosion and the movement of particles over long periods of time, but that erosion and that movement of particles, you know, who knows what it covered up. But I'll let somebody else in. Thanks.
All right, let's go to the campus for the next call. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I was kind of surprised to hear that things like plastics and other products are still only 10% of the use of oil, because the use of plastics has just seems to me has exploded in the last few years. For instance, because of AIDS, everything in the medical community has to be disposable, and nobody draws blood or anything barehanded anymore. So they go through just tons of plastic stuff. And also the third world is using plastic. Now everything in China goes home in a plastic bag. That just started in the last few years. Has plastic use really increased?
Well, plastic use has increased, but in effect what it is the use of oil for petrochemicals has moved up from 3% to 10%.
Mm-hmm.
But it's about 10% right now. I claim that our grandchildren will look at us and say, you burned it? All those lovely
right.
molecules, you just burned it? And that the final use for what the last of the oil is going to be for petrochemicals.
Right. Yeah, I was in college a long time ago when my organic chemistry teacher was already preaching that there are better things to do with it than burn it up.
Hey, good. Now, When did we all take that advice?
Well, I don't know. I had another question. As far as ANWR, I understand that one of the arguments is that the pipeline pressure has to be at a certain level to make the pipeline work efficiently, and with Prudhoe Bay declining, that it won't be of use much longer unless there is a new source of oil to put down it. Does that have anything to do with it?
No, that has a lot to do with it. That pipeline, is now operating at less than capacity and will become uneconomic at some point. And keeping the pipeline running by bringing on ANWR is one of the arguments for doing it. I claim the whole thing is such a small drop in the bucket in terms of the world picture that it doesn't matter whether we drill ANWR or not.
That's interesting. That's an important part of the argument, I would say.
Right.
Now, I understand there's a lot of oil in Kazakhstan. Is that correct? But it's landlocked, and so we're looking for a good place to run a pipeline, and, of course, the best place is through Afghanistan.
Well, there are a few mid-east-sized producers in I've worked in Kyrgyzstan, and I always keep confusing Kyrgyzstan with all the others. There are some big producers in there. They're not in giant oil fields, not of the size that it takes to bail us out.
Mm-hmm.
So we certainly will see strong efforts to produce oil, because it's going to be this struggle to try to keep up. And I claim it's a battle that eventually the oil companies or the oil producers lose, that people are being born too fast and standard of livings are going up too fast.
Right.
And eventually we have to run out of oil. But I'm afraid eventually it's going to come pretty soon, like 3 or 4 years from now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
All right. And we'll see if we can get one more here. Chicago, line four.
Yes, for a quick and dirty fix, I remember about 20 years ago, somebody was proposing dropping low-yield nuclear weapons down into existing wells to fracture the rock and then get more oil out.
There was, and they did try that. One of the big troubles, it was a gas well, I believe in Colorado, but some of the tritium and carbon-14 produced by the bomb then showed up in the natural gas, and if you turn on a regular gas stove in the kitchen, those radioactive materials then wind up in the air in the kitchen, and that kind of put the kibosh on using that. The other possibility was to take an empty hole in the salt dome and simply set off a hydrogen bomb, then mine out the heat. And I did ask Ted Taylor one time at a dinner, if you didn't have to add any safety features and you just wanted to build a raw hydrogen bomb. What would a 1 megaton hydrogen bomb cost? And he started, you know, shutting his eyes, doing this calculation in his head, and I thought, oh, no, this is so classified. And he came out with $40,000. The material for a hydrogen bomb without the military gewgaws that go with it would only cost $40,000. And there was a silly possibility that you could just set them off and use the energy. I'm not advocating doing that, but... you know, this is another one of those possibilities. Regular conventional nuclear power, I think we're going to have to go back to. Everybody's so afraid of it, but I think we're going to have to get over our fear of it and realize the French have been 70% nuclear with their power generation for 20 years now, and they haven't had an accident.
It seems that the bottom line for what you're saying is that we ought to understand that the end of the fossil fuel economy is in sight. And that, in fact, some large petroleum companies have acknowledged that fact. One wonders when the policymakers, the people in government in this country, are going to realize that we are at that point and start acting accordingly.
Well, that's the big difficulty right now, that the newspapers aren't carrying stories like the Shell announcement, and the head of Princeton University Press offered to our local representative, who's the only scientist in the Congress, to supply as many copies of the book as there were senators and congressmen ready to read it. And they didn't even get an answer from Rush Holt, our congressman. So there's a massive disinterest in this subject, and I think I don't want to wind up saying, I told you so. I'd much rather people read the book now and start to take advantage of the warning.
Well, there we must stop because we are at the end of the time. Professor DeFays, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Our guest, Kenneth DeFays, he's Emeritus Professor of Geosciences at Princeton University. The book is titled Hubbert's Peak, The Impending World Oil Shortage. It's published by the Princeton University Press.